1 to 3 this morning. We'll try and cover it in the time we have together. And we hope you have much to contribute this morning. I'd say that to the degree that we appreciate the force of what Romans 1 to 3, this section that we're studying, is about, to the same degree we appreciate what comes after Romans 3. Now, after the introduction in Romans 1, the main point is the sinfulness of unbelievers. And the apostle declares that they are without excuse. Why are they without excuse? How did they know God? That means that even in their own persons, not only through the, of course, their own persons are the created work of God. Notice verse 19. Because that which may be known of God is manifested in them, for God hath shown it unto them. Would you read the your version?
For all that may be known of God by men lies plain before their eyes. Indeed, God himself has disclosed it to them.
Very good. Intelligence. There are some of the traces of God's image still upon man. Sense of right and wrong, righteousness and wickedness. Now they are without excuse, because when they had the evidence of God's power and Godhead, they refused to recognize it. They did not believe. Now the root of all the wickedness in Romans 1 is unbelief. Because when they knew God, they glorified him not as God. They wouldn't believe. Casting away the knowledge of God, what did they do then? The next step. Well, first of all, before that, same step that Eve took. Turned her back on God. Where did she want to go? This way. So we have it in Romans 1 here. They glorified him not as God, neither were thankful. Verse 22, professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. First of all, there's unbelief. There's doubt. God is not supreme in their affections. When God is not supreme in one's affections, what is supreme in his affections? So professing himself wise, professing themselves wise, they became fools. With doubt and unbelief, God was not praised. They were not thankful. Because of all the good things that the Lord had done unto them, they wouldn't recognize him. He wasn't supreme in their affections. They cast God out of their knowledge. The desire for self-exaltation.
I think there's another thought we can get out of that. In this translation it says, they have made fools of themselves, exchanging the splendor of immortal God for an image shaped like mortal man. Now this just doesn't mean the worship of self. It's also making idols of our fellow men. This can happen in the church just as well as it can happen in the world. That we can idolize a preacher, or we can idolize a certain person or group of people, making an image of mortal man and not giving the honor to God. And I think this is something that I've seen happen a great deal. This is why it speaks a lot about not following the preacher, but following the words of God. I think this is something that is taught very plainly here, making an image of mortal man.
Yes. Why does one man worship another man anyway? If he makes an idol out of another man.
I don't know, but it's commonly done.
Why does he make an idol out of anything? What is an idol? Paul says an idol is nothing.
He
like unto himself.
Only like unto himself. Now, you take a heathen. He has to make an idol. Now, this is going to be his conception of God. He's going to fall down worship. Now, where did he get the idea to make it? Where did it come from? It's only gets it out of his own self. And so he makes an idol. And that idol, and he has an idol, and then he clothes it with concept, doesn't he? You got all this heathen mythology, all the things that the gods were doing. And usually they were bad-tempered, and they indulged in wickedness and revenge and lust, just like themselves. So a man, out of the imagination of his own heart, he makes an idol. And this idol is clothed with certain attributes. Now, where does he get that from? He's only himself. So an idol is only what? An expression of what?
Self.
An self. And he falls down and worships it. So what is he worshipping? Self. Idolatry basically is self-worship. Now it can be fixed on an object, can be fixed on men, it can be fixed on an object like the heathen's worship. But basically it's self. If God is not supreme in a person's affection, he'll worship himself. Now, in the Great Controversy, it says we can fashion idols out of false doctrine as verily as we can idols out of wood and stone. We can build up a false doctrine, a fabrication, a system of truth. We fall down worship, idolatry. Many people in the last days will find that whereas they think that they've had the truth that will save them, they find out there's only been an idol fashioned with their own hands. Then a man will rise no higher than upon that which he sets his affection. And this law which Satan introduced, you remember you have the two principles, love finds its source in the heart of God, and self is the other principle. This is Romans 1. God cast out of their affection, profess themselves wise, they make idols, they worship themselves, and when that happens, what way does a man go?
Down.
He goes downward. Now God doesn't push him downward, takes himself down that road. Why did he do that? It's only a natural law, isn't it? I've illustrated it. Two principles like the banana. We wish to grow bananas over in Australia. They grow up in the sheltered valleys, the big broad leaves of the banana plantation. The leaves unbroken, but the big broad leaves would come, the plant would grow up and the leaves would come out and grow out like this. Beautiful, healthy plant. That was natural for them to grow like this. Then a deadly disease got in amongst the bananas that nearly wiped out the whole banana industry. This was a disease called bungee top. And they had to bring quarantine system in to destroy the thing out because it just wiped out the whole plantation. As soon as the inspectors would find one bungee top in the plantation, that whole plant would have to be burned. It was so deadly. What had happened with the bungee top, the plant would grow up and the leaves would come out of the plant. But instead of growing outward like this, a strange phenomenon would happen and the leaves would grow inward. And they'd turn in like this and the plant would just choke itself. That's what sin is. It's inward and it chokes itself. Leads to corruption like a stagnant pool that's not flowing, not giving. Lives to itself and it becomes stagnant. And so in Romans 1, we've got the darkest category of the sins of men. Verse 29, being filled with all unrighteousness, fornication, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, debate, deceit, malignity, whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, despiteful, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents, without understanding, covenant breakers, without natural affection, implacable, unmerciful, and knowing that the judgment of God, they which commit such things are worthy of death, not only do the same, but have pleasure in them that do that. And so we read of the category of the darkest sins of humanity, of the heathen, of those who do not obey God. Thus we say to ourselves, God, I thank thee that I'm not as other men are. Wicked and evil, even as these publicans. And so the apostle moves quickly into Romans 2. This time the believers, thou art inexcusable, O man, whosoever thou art the judges. For now the judges and others do us the same. Now the judges and others do us the same. Wherein thou condemnest another, wherein thou judgest another, thou condemnest thyself, for thou that judgest doest the same thing. The point of Romans 2, the Apostle Paul is saying that the judgment of God is according to truth. In verse 6, that God will render to every man according to his deeds. Upon what is the judgment based? What does the judgment examine? Upon what is it based? What are we justified in the judgment on, and what are we condemned upon? According to what? According to profession? No. What does according say? Deeds. That's what we're judged. That's what we, our destiny decided on. Our deeds determine our destiny. The judgment determines our destiny according to our deeds. And the point of Romans 2 is that addressed to believers, they have a knowledge of God, they approve the things that are more excellent. We may have a profession of God, but after all, profession counts nothing. It's only the fruit that is of any value to God. But also he says in verse 11, for there is no respect of persons with God. What did the Jews imagine? They thought that they were favoured ones, didn't they? Why did God give them the wonderful knowledge of his truth? They misunderstood the reason why God gave these things to them. They thought, well, we're the chosen people. God has given these things because he favours us. Why did God give it to Israel? Well, God has favoured us, hasn't he? Adventists, with great light. Because we are better than other people? Because he respects us above every other people? God is no respecter of persons. Well, why do we have it? For the saving of others. And every man shall be judged according to his work. Romans 2 is important as a basis for the book of Romans, because after his introduction from Romans 1 to 3, much is said about the doctrine of justification by faith. And some consider Romans 3 onwards to the exclusion of Romans 2. But the apostle is very, very careful to lay down the important foundation of works. That works are important. That every man is judged according to his deed. God is no respecter of persons. And everyone who has sinned in the law shall be judged by the law. Tribulation and anguish upon everyone that doeth evil. To the Jew first. Why to the Jew first? Judgment begins at the house of God. And to the Greek or to the Gentile. Also on verse 13. For not the hearers of the law are just before God, but the doers of the law shall be justified. The law says through Moses, the Lord says through Moses, the man that doeth these things shall live in them. The doers of the law shall be justified. Blessed are they that what now? Do his commandments, that they might have right to the tree of life and enter into the gates of the city. Only one who is a doer of the law of God will ever enter into the pearly gates. God is no respecter of persons. One man might say he has faith. Faith is something that I can't see, and no one can see another man's faith. The angels can't really see faith. God only can understand faith. But what can the universe, who is interested in the judgment, see when the books are open? And what does the work prove?
The reality
of our faith. All men are judged according to their works. So we come down that to verse 17. Behold, thou art called a Jew, restest in the law, makest thy boast of God, and knowest his will, and approvest the things that are more excellent, being instructed out of the law, and art confident that thou thyself art a guide to the blind, a light to them that sit in darkness, and instructor of the foolish, a teacher of babes, which hath the form of knowledge and the truth of the law. Therefore that teachest another, teachest not thyself. Thou that preachest the man should not steal, dost thou steal. And it comes down to the end of Romans 3, showing that those who have circumcision keep not the law. Does the circumcision merit them anything?
No.
What was circumcision a sign of?
A conversion.
Yes? Tells us here of commandment keeping. Circumcision was a sign of commandment keeping. Now when those who had this ordinance did not keep the commandments of God, what profited the ordinance to them?
Nothing.
Not a thing. What lesson is we have today concerning this? What is the Sabbath a sign of? Well, if we're not sanctified, what advantage is the Sabbath to us?
None.
In fact, the more condemnation.
Dishonor God.
The name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles to us. So he comes down to Romans 3 after proving in Romans 2 that we are no better than they. What advantage hath a Jew, or what profit is there in circumcision? Well, what profit is there in being a Jew? What profit is there being an Adventist if we're not better than the heathen? Well, verily we're not. What advantage is there being in the church? Well, there's some advantage. The Bible says so. We have the oracles of God. We have the truth of God. And then in verse 9, what then? Are we better than they? Are we who have the greatest light and truth of any other people upon the earth? Are we any better than they? Any better other than the natural man? Well, surely we're better than these men in Romans 1. These unmentionable things here. We're not even any better than that. All men are absolutely on the same level. All understand. Verse 19. After saying there's none good, none, no, not one, verse 19. Now we know that what things soever the law saith, it saith to them who are under the law, that how many mouths might be stopped, and all stand guilty before God. We see ourselves not a bit better than the vile of sin. We're all plunged in the same pit. We're all lost from the condemnation. We all stand guilty. Before him. Now I don't plan to say too much on Romans 1 to 3. Some of you have been doing some study on it. We're lost and sinful. Now the miracles and parables of Jesus. Who had the miracles and parables? We saw in our lesson, in the last lesson, that self must die. The root of all sin is corrupt. Its fruit will be evil. Now, there's two ways that the man will go. One is he'll become a rank unbeliever. Unbelief. Bible symbolism, that's Egypt. Put religion away completely. Have nothing to do with it. That's Egypt. Who is God that I should hear him and obey him? Now that's one way that the natural man will go. Now the other way that the natural man will go, he'll become religious. You put on a cloak of religion, exceedingly so sometimes. But what is his religion to do? There's something left out of it. It doesn't destroy this evil nature. It's something to, for him to become religious, that he's going to find the way of eternal life by going through a system of truth, by professing to some system of religion. Whether it's Adventism, Methodism, Catholicism, it doesn't matter what it is. It's all the same. And really, that's Babylon. That's all Babylon is. And the whole world, the wicked world, is divided into two classes, Babylon and Egypt, as far as the natural man goes. In the last prophecy, Babylon is going to come up, overcome Egypt. The whole world is going to become religious, having the form of godliness, but denying the power thereof. Now, we can be in the Adventist church with the Babylonian garment on. We have the remnant, which is the Adventist church, and we have Babylon, all the apostate systems of religion. We often think that here in Jones, I don't know if anybody read Jones here in the 1895 bulletin. The thought he brings out is this. He said, many people get the idea that only if they get out of the Methodist church and out of the Presbyterian church and get out into the Adventist church, they're out of Babylon because they've got the right system of doctrine. We can sit in the Adventist church with a Babylonian garment on. When the Lord comes to the judgment, he says, friend, now come and sit down and hear this. You're not wearing the garment of Christ's righteousness, you've still got on the garment of self. Take him away and cast him into outer darkness, put him back in Babylon where he belongs. So this is Romans 2, virtually. It goes towards here, and here's Romans 1, but they're no better. Steps to Christ. We may have flattered ourselves, as did Nicodemus, that our life has been upright, that our moral character is correct, and think that we need not humble the heart before God like the common sinner. But when the light of Christ shines into our souls, we shall see how impure we are. We shall discern the selfishness of motive, the enmity against God, which has defiled every act of life. Then we shall know that our own righteousness is indeed as filthy rags. It doesn't say our wickedness is as filthy rags. What is as filthy rags? Our righteousness. And that the blood of Christ alone can cleanse us from the defilement of sin and renew our hearts in his own likeness. One ray of the glory of God, one gleam of the purity of Christ, penetrating the soul, makes every spot of defilement painfully distinct, and lays bare the deformity and defects of the human character. It makes apparent the unhallowed desires, the infidelity of the heart, the impurity of the lips. The sinner's acts of disloyalty in making void the law of God are exposed in his sight, and his spirit is stricken and afflicted under the searching influence of the Spirit of God. He loathes himself as he views the pure, spotless character of Christ. And she goes on to describe Paul also. The same experience came to him. Judged outwardly, Philippians 3 says, as touching the righteousness which is of the law, blameless. If any man thinketh that he hath whereof he can trust in the flesh, I more. Circumcised the eighth day, Hebrew of the Hebrews, a Pharisee, doing this, doing that, is touching the righteousness of the law, blameless. He said, I was alive without the law once, but when the law came, sin revived and I died. And the Spirit of God took the law of God and took it to his heart. Instead of seeing himself as a righteous man, Pharisee of the Pharisee, he was the greatest sinner. You know, Paul was the greatest Pharisee. Pharisee of the Pharisee. Well, he became the greatest apostle. Not until he saw himself as the greatest sinner. And then he said, these things which were gained for me, those I counted lost for Christ. And he says, I do count them but done, or refuse, some translation again. All his own righteousness, that he might win Christ.
Is